Okay. 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 Hello, and fang du
Okay,
mal an.
second try.
Ja.
Okay, welcome to Many Roads Lead to Rome.
To
No,
Rome?
oh
No,
yeah,
to
falsch.
Om.
Again.
Okay.
Okay.
Hello.
And welcome to Many Roads Lead to Om. My name
Om.
is Roland Heap.
And my name is Gary Streberg.
And we welcome you to episode 20 of our little podcast. And this is the first time we do it in English. So we have to have a few words with our German listeners now, please. Anybody who doesn't want to hear this can skip for a few seconds. Ja, herzlich willkommen zur Episode 20 von Viele Wege führen nach Om.
Um,
Ja, haben wir ja
ich
gerade
habe
schon
noch oben
gesagt.
gesagt.
Haben wir ja gerade schon gesagt, wer wir sind. Das wisst ihr ja auch. Ihr seid vielleicht ein bisschen irritiert. Wieso haben die jetzt gerade Englisch gesprochen? Die Lösung oder die Antwort ist ganz einfach.
Because it's our first podcast in English.
Genau.
Es ist, weil unser erster Podcast in Englisch, genau.
Genau. Unser erster Gast ist nämlich, unser Gast meine ich diesmal, ist nämlich James Jesso, ein Kanadier. Der kann nun mal kein Deutsch. Da mussten wir wohl oder übel mal Englisch reden. Das heißt, ihr müsst jetzt wohl oder übel auch Englisch hören. Und deswegen ab jetzt geht es Englisch weiter.
Nicht ständig, aber ab und zu mal.
Aber für diesen
Für
Podcast.
diesen Podcast.
Nein,
Ach so,
nächste
jetzt. Ach so.
Podcast, nächste Podcast, wieder deutscher
Weil,
Gast.
also,
Oder wir alleine,
okay.
keine
Dann hatte
Ahnung.
ich das jetzt falsch
Nee,
verstanden.
nee,
Okay.
nee, nee, so meine ich das nicht.
Ja,
Okay,
ja.
so now back to English. Welcome to our international listeners. We never said that before.
No, no.
No. It's really great. So we are doing this podcast for a year now. And you guys probably have never heard of us before because we usually do it in German.
In German.
And we have German guests. But we were so interested in talking to our guest today, James Jesso, that we decided to just open up the podcast. And from now on, every once in a while, we'll hopefully have some guests from England, America. I mean, I don't speak any other language than English and German. So there will
Yeah.
probably not be any French or Chinese guests here unless you do, like, I don't know, have some talents which I have never heard of before. Yeah.
No, I don't.
So, yeah, this time it's in English. And James Jesso, for, I don't know, hopefully some people have heard of him before. He is an author. He wrote a few books about his experience with psilocybin mushrooms. And he's also a prolific writer. He's writing essays and on his website, Adventures Through the Mind or www.jamesljesso.com. You can find his writing. He's always also been a guest on many other podcasts before. And he has a very unique and, well, probably not unique, but very accessible and really great take on the psychedelic experience and how he handled it. And we talked to him in his home, no, not in his home in Calgary, but he was in Calgary and we were in Bochum, which is
Yes.
a very weird city somewhere in Germany. And
Near Düsseldorf. It's always near
it's
Düsseldorf.
always near Düsseldorf or Cologne. Actually, it's not that near, but anyway.
But yeah.
But thanks to Skype, we were able to do this interview without leaving our home. And we hope you enjoy it. And you might want to check back once in a while or become like friend of us on our Facebook site. And then you will get informed if we have an English guest again. And that might be of interest to you. Or you can also brush up your German and listen to our German episodes, which you can find on iTunes, of course, and on our website, which we will link on our. Well, on our link website, that's stupid to say. No, it's Viele Wege führen nach Om, but that's too difficult to spell. So maybe James will post something or we'll do something on our Twitter page. We don't know. You'll find us if you want to.
Okay.
All right. So without further ado, please enjoy our talk with James and we hope it's going to be fun.
Yeah.
Whenever you're ready, you start. I
Yeah,
don't know
we
if
are
you have like an
ready.
intro that
Okay.
you got to
Yeah,
say.
we do the intro later. You know, I think we just start off with welcoming you. Welcome, James W. Jesso, to Many Ways Lead to Om. This is very weird for
Yeah.
us to say because usually, you know, it's a German thing.
Yeah.
Yes, we welcome James W. Jesso today to our first English-speaking podcast, to our first international guest, to our first Skype thing. So it's a lot of firsts. So we hope everything works out fine. And if not, then it's entirely our fault.
Yeah.
So, yeah, let's just see where this goes. First of all, welcome, James. Thanks for agreeing to talk to us.
Thanks, man. Thanks for inviting me.
You are in Canada.
Yes, I am.
In
Calgary, Alberta, to be exact.
Calgary, yeah. Alberta. It's, yeah. I think we should start with a short introduction from our end, and then you can talk a little bit about yourself. I think sure. I first heard about you when you did your Indiegogo campaign about 2 years back, I think.
2013.
Right. You were looking for like some help for a book tour for your first book, Decomposing the Shadow, Lessons from the Psilocybin Mushroom, which is a very good book and which I hope we can talk about in a minute. And then from then on, you wrote another book, Soundscapes and Psychedelics, which is a shorter book, but as interesting as the first one, of course. And you wrote some essays, appeared on several podcasts. You're creating a website, Adventures Through the Mind, I think it's
called. Adventures Through the Mind, yeah.
But it's still under www.jameswgesso.com, as far as I recall.
Yeah, well, the whole website process is the last 3.5 years of my life have been me going from knowing almost nothing other than how to work a wage position to say, I'm going to find a cultural groove and then carve an elaborate niche to fuel myself and my career in the way that I want it to be. So I learned a lot of lessons about how to properly brand websites and stuff too along the process. So
it's a very beautiful website, and I can just recommend everybody to check it out because very it also nice. Features a lot of essays that you wrote. It features videos, other podcasts or audio files. So it really gives a good overview of your work. And plus you also just returned from an extensive time in the Amazon, as far as I know, working with ayahuasca.
Yeah, I mean, compared to some of the people out here that practice ayahuasca who haven't gone to the Amazon, it would appear as extensive, but relative to the people really investing themselves down there, it was barely scratching the surface.
Yeah, probably, but still, it was your latest venture into the inner space, I guess. And also, that's basically what we know of you. I read your books. I listened to some of your podcasts, watched your videos, and I think you really have a lot of interesting things to say. So why don't you start saying some interesting things? First, maybe introduce the people to yourself from your end, and also maybe tell us a little bit about how you got into the whole, psychedelic work. How did you end up there, and what was your story about that?
Well, that introduction is pretty good. The story that how I got into the psychedelic work, like this significantly abridged version, is that I moved to Australia and took LSD for the first time, and that saved me but also opened me up into a lifestyle that left me pretty scattered up, due to a lot of reckless drug use. And eventually things unfolded to the point where I was in Thailand and trying to deconstruct myself, not understanding what that means, based on this idea that psychedelics were good for me, even though I knew that I was all scattered. Sorry, I just woke up all scattered in my mind and in my soul. And this actually an interesting story that I probably won't tell in full, but maybe one day I'll write about it.
We are glitching. Glitching.
Yeah. Excuse me. There's a glitch.
Okay. Yeah. I'm pausing. Wait.
Okay.
Are we back?
I think we're back.
I guess so. Yeah,
okay, Thailand.
Yeah, okay. So, an interesting story that I may or may not write about one day, and I won't go into fullest, but by the end of my time in Thailand, I spent the last 48 hours pretty much in and out of sleep, thinking I was dying and continuing to tell myself that I couldn't die in Thailand because I had to get home and say hello to my mom or something. Like it's like the only thing that held me together. But I got back to Ontario after 18 months or something being gone and was pretty fucked up in the head. Is it okay if I swear on your podcast?
Sure.
Yeah, sure.
We're always explicit because I usually say fuck at some
Go
point
ahead,
and then
so.
We get an E.
Okay, cool. So I'm all fucked up in the head and feeling I guess what I could now diagnose, self-diagnose, is like borderline personality disorder and sort of like mild paranoid schizophrenic ideas and depression, like aggravated depression, and just wasn't going well for me. And some strange set of self-justifications, I decided that mushrooms might be the thing that helped me. And I'm along with having started a Reiki practice, which I still consider to be a very interesting point of meditation in my life. I spent about 13 months taking mushrooms once a month, every month, and at about a 4 gram dose range. But the quantity dose, I don't think is as descriptive as the quality dose, which was somewhere between enough to fully break through and not so much that I was totally incapacitated. And in these meditations, which was every full moon, I would just say, "Show me where it's hurting, show me where the wounds are, help me heal." And 13 months later, I was in a healthy place in my life and was inspired to follow my creative passions, which included writing a book. Now, there was more than this than just the mushrooms. The mushrooms weren't they weren't the means, but they were a part of the way because they allowed me to once a month excavate, consolidate, and integrate the things from the past, the things that I had learned, and the potential steps forward in becoming the fullest expression of me as a healthy human being, along with the various other things in my life. And that was leading to, like I said, embodiment of my creative passions towards saying, like, hey, I'm going to make a career out of this. I'm going to say, no, I don't subscribe to needing to be picked up by a major company, and no, I don't subscribe to needing to be a wage worker my whole life. I'm going to make it, and I'm going to be successful in these things, and I feel like I have a gift to offer. And then invested my whole life into pulling it off, like left my job and said, I'm going to write a book. And then 3 years later, I started running the Indiegogo campaign that you mentioned.
So, I mean, when reading your book, there's a lot of really deep and very basic. I don't mean basic in simple, but really the groundwork of spiritual ideas in there. And my question is, have you been, before you took any kind of psychedelics, I mean, before the LSD experience, were you in any way inclined to these ideas already, or was it nothing in your life at that point?
Yeah, I was definitely inclined to the ideas. I grew up in a household where and still together too, but my parents were of divided Christian denominations, but they were both very dedicated to their faith. And my father was a Jehovah's Witness, my mother was a Pentecostal. And there are several things that came out of that at the time was very confusing, but then later became benefits. One of which is the Jehovah's Witnesses tend to be very dedicated to an academic study of religion, which is both a blessing and a curse, because in some ways it's great to be well read, and in other ways too much head disconnects one from the essence of what we might call God, which is heart. And my mother was very emotional and embraced a lot of the mythos. And so what I got out of that was a tendency to want to discuss the ideas, to think about them, to talk about them, to explore, to study, and to look at them critically, because I was getting two different stories, which later, as I got to my sort of breakout adolescent phase or rebellion phase, I started getting sort of like the antithesis of my previous Christian bubble, and started moving from there into philosophy. I was reading things like Krishnamurti. I read, I'm not sure if I'm going to pronounce his name right, but Trungpa Shambhala, the warrior's guide, I think when I was 20 or 19 or something. And these sort of started me on the path of meditation and questioning the essence of self. So it was all priming. Like, psychedelics can expose one to these beautiful states, to these spiritual states of awareness, if we're going to use that term. But whether or not these spiritual states of awareness manifest in a way that can be later applied into a person's life will depend on what substrate of information has been primed into that person's psyche. So I had already been, priming with study of like I mean, maybe most of us have read this, maybe not in Germany, but things like the Celestine Prophecy when I was a teenager, and like I said, reading Krishnamurti and reading Trungpa, and reading Carlos Castaneda, though I look at that more as playful fictional mythos than anything else these days. But these things all sort of like primed me for these experiences. And then when I had this sort of basic spiritual idea, but I didn't understand the realness of the experience so much as I understood the practice as being a process of developing, myself as a person. And my explorations in Australia took me into the wildest dimensions of weird states of mind, which was also, I mean, sort of my biggest dark night of the soul, next to the one that I just went through between my ayahuasca experiences, which I'm sure we'll get to. And so I had this spiritual concepts that I've been building up, and then in that time frame that I was getting wild, I started going really deep into psychedelic philosophy because I needed to self-justify what I was doing. And if I could say, well, look at guys like Leary and McKenna, and Huxley, these guys are telling me that this is intelligent work that I'm doing, getting fucked up all the time, right? So this is good. I mean, later these became the basis for making mature choices. Later these the work of these men became the sort of the philosophical grounds for me to make more, I mean, I wouldn't call myself a grown-up, but more adult decisions and lifestyle choices regarding the use of psychedelics or entheogens or whatever terms. And so with, going to Thailand, and there was this whole like spiritual thing, and having explored the festival culture a little bit in Australia, these things were all sort of like opening me up to merging these two, say, sets of experience in my life, sets of non-ordinary experience, because the spiritual essence of self is almost like a non-ordinary experience, and then the psychedelic one is clearly non-ordinary. And then having it integrate later in my mushroom practice with applying the Reiki and applying meditation, and at that time I was applying a lot of binaural beat stuff and looking to connect with what I would later understand to be God inside of myself, inside and outside, like the interpenetrative holographic nature of the divine, And yeah, I feel like I'm trailing off a little bit, but I
No,
guess,
no, it's.
yeah, so I have a tendency for these spiritual things. It wasn't the psychedelics themselves so much as they were the catalysts to offer me a fuller understanding of what it was I was experiencing inside of myself, and to be able to deconstruct the working of my mind and the working of my subconscious by exposing those processes to my surface awareness. And yeah, that's the role that they played more so than actually being the catalyst. I didn't find spirituality in psychedelics.
Yes.
Psychedelics accentuated them, accentuated that process in myself.
So after more or less using it as a kind of entertainment slash spiritual entertainment thing and really getting fucked up, at some point you realize, okay, I need to really kind of turn it into a practice. And that's what you did when you basically took psilocybin every month for 13 months and, really worked with it. How did you get that idea? Was it something that just jumped in your mind? Did somebody else turn you on to that? Or was
I
it?
guess I could backtrack, I could do a little bit of psychic archaeology into my history. There's a few specific experience that led me to that, and well, one of which we'll say is McKenna. But looking back at some of McKenna's work, the stuff I was listening to at the time was really reflective of the state of mind I was in my usage, which is his more weird stuff. He's got some really powerful talks on the nature of mind and society and the potential role of entheogens in human consciousness. And then there's other talks that are just like totally out there and just like balls to the wall weird. And those are the ones I was getting into. So the premise of the mushrooms having some sort of extra special value was present for me. But what really got me was the experience I had in the Botanic Gardens in Melbourne with a couple friends of mine who remain unnamed, but one of them was a like an Australian from Perth with a low sitting ball cap, who was really quiet but a really nice friendly guy. And then the other one was a Swiss Frenchman with a giant handlebar mustache, who was one of my favorite adventuring buddies. Are we frozen? Are you all right?
Yeah, we
Are
were
we okay?
frozen right now. Just start with the Australian with the ball cap.
Okay, cool. I've got it in my mind. So, and then my friend with this, the Swiss Frenchman with the handlebar mustache, who was one of my favorite adventurers. We all took mushrooms and went to the Botanic Gardens in the daytime, and I had what would be kind of like a spiritual experience, sort of, but it was just happy. It was really open. And that day, my friend with the handlebar mustache had later said that whatever it was that happened to him corrected some psychic damage he had incurred through taking ketamine 3 years earlier that had just changed him in a way that he always looked back on and said, like, I wish I hadn't had that experience because it changed me, you know, in a negative way, and that the mushrooms fixed him. And I was in the midst of a conversation of, you know, like with a bunch of trippers, and somebody was like, oh yeah, mushrooms are like the reset tool. And, you know, this is like this is a part of the cultural rhetoric that almost opens a person up to the potential, but kind of holds them back because of simplicity. The same kind of rhetoric that I have intended to change the dynamics of through my work. But they said these things, I was like, oh. And jumping ahead a little bit, I end up being in at Rainbow Serpent and eating, you know, like we'll just call it too much or just enough LSD. And I was told, I guess in my experience, I was shown that I was addicted to drugs. And I was with a really good friend who I was so out of it and anxious and uncomfortable that he had to take care of me. And this came to me and I had to openly express it. Mind you, time was moving infinitely slow and we were locked inside of a car because I was afraid of my other friends who were on MDMA to like mess with us, you know, and I couldn't handle people messing with me right now, you know. So we're in this little car and I'm like panning the flashlight back and forth and looking at how I can see like the fractal energetic structure of the cellular organization of dust on the dash, and it's really interesting, and I'm having all these insights about my choices. So I look over to my best friend at the time and I tell him, I have to say, like, I'm addicted to drugs and I don't know if I know how to stop myself, and I've been telling myself I'll stop for me, but I feel like in this moment I need to tell you that I'm going to stop for you because I love you. You're my best friend, and I don't believe that I can do it for myself, but I believe I might be able to do it for you. Now, later, this was an expression of the LSD, and he synchronized. He was like, yeah, man, we'll stop together. We'll stop taking drugs. And then, like, the next weekend, he was like, you know what? I realize that I don't actually have an issue, and I'm going to continue living my life. And I was like, cool, man. I realize that I don't really need to do this for you. I need to do this for me, so it's all good. But part of that was I was like, I need to cleanse all the things that I'm abusing. And I took out everything I felt like I was abusing. So that included obviously drugs, right? But that also included coffee, caffeine being a drug, a delicious drug that I'm enjoying this moment. But caffeine and alcohol, clearly also a drug. Cannabis, clearly also a drug, and all other the substances that I was using. I also started to cut out the food that I was using that had a drug-like effect because of my compulsion to eating it and the sort of dopamine rush of pleasure I would get eating shitty foods on the street. Even if it was like the most delicious pizza in Melbourne, it was still like pizza every day, twice a day maybe. So I cut that out and went on a fast. I realized that I was being promiscuous in a way that was unhealthy. It was an expression of being unhealthy. So I sort of like called off some of the relationships I was or like interacting with, and I felt like I was over-consuming socializing. So I decided I needed to, you know, compile all of these things together and go away. I had a friend drive me up to Otways National Park. This friend is still a very, very close friend of mine, and she dropped me off there, and I was there for 2 nights. And in the whole, like the full day that I was there, between the 2 nights I slept, I ate a bunch of mushrooms because they were quote unquote a reset, and just walked around and explored what happened. And that was my first sort of like spiritual mushroom journey, my first solo mushroom journey. And the cool experiences that I had just roaming around this combination of Fern Gully and Pine Woods. Like you'd go lower altitude and it was like a fern gully, and then you'd walk up a little bit and it was, like temperate pine wooded areas. And the insight that I had on the value of my relationships and how not to take advantage of them and recognize how important it is to have people that care to listen to you and people that you care to hear speaking, that you care to share presence with. And that was my first sort of spiritual mushroom journey. And it was sometime later that I reflected back and said, whoa, that really helped me. Maybe that's what will help me now, we'll say like 4 months later, living in my parents' basement. So that's the long
Yeah,
way of how I
it's
figured it out.
interesting to see that you basically had to face all your addictions, which I mean, and I guess is probably the root cause of most of our suffering in this realm, whatever you want to call it, and stop it and really be present to, okay, this is not serving me right now, and then go the next step in resetting yourself, and then on a longer term, like 13 months is over a year, that's a long time to really work on this one by one by one. By reading your book, the two things that most struck me were the themes of surrender and fear. Maybe we can go into this a little bit because I think this kind of always sums up the major things that happen, in a spiritual context. Maybe you can, talk a little bit about how these two things came up in your 13 months of psilocybin use and how you dealt with them. Because, I mean, your book is called Decomposing the Shadow, so we're talking about fear, darkness, negativity, and then, of course, how do we do this? And I think surrender is a big part of that. So maybe you can give us a little bit of insight.
Yeah, well, I mean, it seems rather clear. Just like thinking about the themes and mentioning the title of the book, it's almost like it fills itself in. But the process for me was, I knew I was going to be uncomfortable. I almost knew consistently I was going to be in overwhelming states of loneliness or pain or regret, sadness. I knew these things were going to come, though sometimes I knew they were going to come, and they only came long enough for me to acknowledge that they were there, and then all of a sudden it was play, and I'm rolling around in the park and laughing by myself and giggling, whatever. But the biggest lesson that I got was that the, well, I guess the true lessons come when you transcend the urge for comfort. And surrender is to say, essentially, submit. I think, Sufism, like submission and surrender, are kind of used interchangeably, though a lot of people in the Western world would see submission as something negative. But it's just to say, okay, if this is the honesty of my emotional experience, regardless of how uncomfortable it is, I just say, okay, show it to me. Fine. I give in. I surrender. Let it happen. And the things that we would normally posture and guard ourselves from, which are the very essence of what directs our unconscious behavioral patterns, like say the detrimental behavioral patterns that function unconsciously as a result of compensation patterns for maintaining a defensive posture for issues that are going on inside of us, wounds, traumas, etc. Even if they're very, very simple, even if they're just very seemingly mundane experiences from childhood that have encoded themselves in the limbic system in a place that doesn't actually exist where we can reach with words, but still has a strong emotional charge. When we surrender to these things, then the posturing goes away and the defense patterns go away. And of course, I write about this clearly in the book, but the emotions can come up at this point. And it's the repressed and unaddressed elements of these emotions that cause us to have these weird behavioral patterns because we don't want to deal with them. They have to stay in there and they can't come out to the surface mind, which they always do. They always do in some way or another. And so we posture, we guard, and then when we surrender, they come up and we can experience them. And I say we metabolize them. And I use the metaphor of a sapling, right? I kind of blend metaphors, but the metaphor of a sapling, the metaphor of undigested food, that when we let these things flow out of us, the darker elements of ourselves, which is to say the stuff that we choose to keep behind us, the stuff that we choose not to lay the light of our awareness upon, can be broken up. This undigested clumps of emotional energy can be released, and in the process of surrendering to the emotions and allowing the emotions to unfold, there can be a metabolizing of the, say, held up emotional energy, the latent emotional energy in those things, to be recycled back into the soil. This is where the sapling metaphor comes in. The soil of our psycho-spiritual development, psycho-spiritual being a reference to the maturation process of finding ourselves more aligned with who we are, naturally are expressing ourselves without trauma that we've incurred throughout life. And the nutrients would come through and nourish us in this way. And to say decompose the shadow is obviously a reference to mushrooms. And actually, the title of the book came from a guy named Ben Hayden, a local author here in Calgary that wrote a book called Om Hole. It was very interesting. And he was the first person to look over the manuscript. And he was like, I think this title would be better for your book. And immediately I was like, yeah. But the decomposing the shadow is to say the mushrooms, which are in many ways the decomposers of the planet, almost in some way the planet's immune system, and various other amazing things that this kingdom operates in the ecology of the planet. But they help to decompose, so you bring the mushrooms in and they help to decompose the shadow, the darkness, the repressed bits. And when this happens, the dying, decaying, rotting thing that's not going there gets to rot, and the nutrients get released back into the soil so they can be utilized for the new growth of other things. And the biggest thing that I feel blocks most people in being able to benefit from the mushroom experience is the posturing around the darkness and a fear of the quote-unquote bad trip. And part of the book was to say, hey, look, let's take a exploration, a journey through what this mushroom experience might be offering us. And if this is the case, then would it not be that the darker elements could be the most beneficial? And if that's the case, and we understand that, can we stop posturing? And if we stop posturing, can we allow for this process to unfold naturally and in turn mitigate the potential harms that come from an anxiety of defense when these dark things come up, which block the energetic flow, which is always abundant? And when I say energetic flow, I mean emotional flow, psychological flow, physical flow, whatever. It's all energy. That block this flow and create weird sort of experiences. I think that a lot of people who have the quote-unquote bad mushroom trip and never go back again is because a very sensitive element of their self was trying to be exposed, and the blocking, the fear, the anxiety, the posturing, the defensiveness, the guarding creates almost like a glitch in the psychic matrix and develops mild expressions of post-traumatic stress disorder around that thing. That's why you could mention mushrooms and all of a sudden the person's entire demeanor changes, right? And I wanted to mitigate that harm because they're such a powerful medicine for doing the opposite. But if we don't understand that, we could put ourselves in harm's way by using these things ignorantly, which for the most part, psychedelics, the biggest danger to using these substances, you know, is ignorant use.
Yeah, I think you made a very, very good point in that, in the book too, that, I mean, what you did wasn't like what lots of people do, taking these substances just, you know, for the fun of it on some festival or wherever, but you really deliberately, you made your intention, and I think that's a very important point, to really use these to work on yourself, and you also, you put a lot of attention and energy on it. I mean, you really stayed with it. I mean, as I said, 13 months, 13 times, and really going almost full on all the time. That's a lot of courage too, you know, because especially as you were facing all the dark stuff, and I think somewhere in your book you basically mentioned that that's actually going back, even though you know it's going to be the worst thing that ever happened to you. That's really the work, and that's totally, I mean, I can totally feel that, and I think that's what a lot of people, if they maybe hear this podcast, and if they probably ever had a bad experience on some level, be it on an intentional basis or just on a fun trip, which didn't turn out to be fun can really learn from this and see, you know what, actually, this is not just, this is a medicine. This is really something that you really need to work with either by yourself, but, I mean, you did it yourself as far as I know. You did you have a...
The first few, obviously, I was, you know, quite anxious about what this was going to be. I found a friend that I was like, hey, do you by chance want to just hang out with me while I roam around the city high on mushrooms and just like be there for me till 4 or 5 in the morning? And he was like, yep.
Yeah, I think that's very good advice to find somebody who you trust and who's probably sober most. That was probably a good thing. Yeah. And to look out for you, because, I mean, in these situations, you can, you know, just not by, but just by accident, you do weird stuff, you don't see something. And especially if you walk around the city, that's probably not a good idea if you're by yourself and you're tripping.
Having the reference point of safety that is a person that you trust can be really beneficial. Though once you move into the solo, there's a whole added level of anxiety and fear around the integrity of your psychological, physiological vessel when you're exploring that offer a whole new subset of challenges and thus potential lessons, gains, benefits, etc.
Mm-hmm. So you'd say that was a part that was also very important to at some point just be alone with the experience.
Yeah, to be your only reference point, I guess, for the self, you to be your only reference point, because, and I don't know what the demographic is, but maybe going a little bit into the metaphysical realm, even just having a person present there, if you wanted to stay on the really physical ends of things, the materialistic ends of things, their, you know, body posture, their subtle movements, you know, maybe even the way that they're breathing, this type of information is being received, it has an effect on you. The history of yourself and your relationship to that person, it has an influential effect. And furthermore, like beyond just the material ends of things, the relationship between the two of you on an energetic end has an effect. And even the way that this person is perceiving you, perceiving your processes, is going to have an effect on the, and I'm going to use Sheldrake's term, you know, the morphogenetic context of your experience. It's going to change the information that will be picked up and received and rendered within your experience. So again, the safe person, it can be very beneficial, but there's a whole new subset of lessons that come out of the solo experience.
Yeah, that makes sense. That makes sense. And also, I think when you talk about surrender, another very good point is also what you said, that submission is something people don't really like to hear, which is, I think, a really difficult aspect of that whole idea. But I think it's very important, because I think, to me, surrender, it really means accepting the situation, whatever it is. I mean, we can also decouple it from the psychedelic experience. I mean, that's just one thing. It's basically what's happening in life all the time. And I think what is still often there is the hope, or, you know, the belief that, oh, it's gonna be over at some point. And I don't think that's real surrender. I think the real surrender is really when you accept that it is. And even if it's like a bad thing, or you feel it is a bad thing, then I think that's the hardest part, to really stay with that and not really hope. I mean, they say hope dies last or something like that, because that's the last thing that goes in the surrender process. Yes, there's still hope, oh, it's going to change, or it's going to turn out fine. No, at that point, at some point, you even have to let go of that. And that's, I mean, to me, that's very horrible, just from the experiential point of view.
Yeah, to accept the psychic Armageddon of one's emotional collapse within a psychedelic experience, and outside of it, the surrender. And this is something that I think is very important, because yes, the experiences themselves, there is a set of, we'll say, there's an emotional metabolism that's happening there, and there's an option to perceive things unfolding. There's a release of stuff. So there is like its own process going on there that's unique to the psychedelic experience. But I mean, Jung said that everything in the psyche is symbolic, and I'm extrapolating from that. I'm just going to go off on my own thing, which is, you know, the conscious mind, the thinking mind usually works in a structured pattern, some sort of organized symbolism, which many of us, it's verbal, right? And then some of us, it's pictorial. But for many of us, it's verbal. Some of us, it's somatic, and that's really interesting. But we render these symbolic processes in the subconscious as these verbal processes, the languaging structures within the thinking mind, which are influenced by not only the content of one's life, the diet, which could be informational diet in the form of conversations and social stimuli, and what you read and podcasts you listen to or whatever, and then also the structure of the media itself, right? Which Marshall McLuhan talks about, the medium is the message, right? Though he disconnects from the content, which I think is false. But even the medium structures the way the brain works. Do you read long form books? Do you cruise Facebook? Do you do YouTube channels? These things all affect the way the content is structured in the mind. So we've got the subconscious symbolic processes, and then we have the conscious thinking mind. And when we take the psychedelics, we remove the conscious thinking mind. When we go into meditative states, we remove the conscious thinking mind, and we allow the symbolic elements of the subconscious to unfold into surface awareness without the thinking mind employed. And when we do this in a ritualized context, and I don't mean ritual as in, you know, like feathers and rattles and whatever else, but ritual as in I'm making a thing of this. I'm creating a space for certain larger symbolic processes to unfold. You can find this in the psychedelic experience. Oftentimes I find it in contact improvisation training in dance class. And as these symbolic things unfold, such as learning the process of surrender or accepting the presence of dark emotional content or dark emotional potential within the self, in the ritualized place, it works as almost like a personal, I don't know if I'm going to use the right terminology here, but it's almost like remapping one's personal mythos so that the change that happens in this ritualized place, this safe space, can have a cascading effect across the person as a whole. And so all of a sudden, learning the process of surrender to the intensity of loneliness allows you to navigate the normal, say like the more surface expressions of loneliness that might come up in your everyday life. Learning how to surrender in general becomes something that you've cultivated as a skill set, especially when you have the language to take those experiences from their ritualized context and understand them as holistic processes of personal development all across life. Which means for psychedelics, for example, it's not just a trip. It's not where you can just like shelve it away in your psyche as it didn't matter, I was on drugs, right? And it's not just a technique that you're learning in the dance. I love contact improv, and so I reference it a lot, but it's not just learning how to fly or be flown. It's a whole process of understanding how to offer yourself to be supported, or to say, yes, I'm willing to support you in the play of weight, or to trust in one's body, to trust in one's dance partner and stuff like this. These cascade out into the rest of your life.
Yeah, I think this is what we said. It's great because, in a sense, you kind of train and learn, and then you apply it to real life. Otherwise, it's also, I mean, it's fruitless. It's useless. I mean, you learn, and you kind of put the beacon inside of yourself, and you have that beacon which you can refer to in regular life. And I really I like that you mentioned that several times, that the psychedelic experience itself can be totally futile if you do not have like the whatever you want to do, like kind of a practice, like a remembrance practice, like some kind of practice that you refer to that experience and keep that going in your life, and then it will just vanish.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the big three, I guess, from all the psychedelic research in the 60s before it got shut down by fearful government structures, was you know, set setting and dose.
Right.
Mm. Right. But the fourth, that obviously as we watch the resurgence of public discourse on these topics come back, right, is integration.
Mm-hmm.
Set, setting, dose, and integration. These four elements, all four of them are very important to integrate and or not integrate, to fine-tune the experience to one's best interests and one's personal intentions. But I would just like to accentuate that that doesn't necessarily mean that there's only one way to achieve benefit. Anyone can choose to use psychedelics in their own right in any way that they want, right? I mean, obviously there's governmental structures, and I don't encourage anyone ever to do anything illegal or put themselves in harm's way, etc. But as a, on like a philosophical end for the freedom of consciousness, I would say that regardless, it doesn't even need to be safe. If someone is making their own choice to explore their mind and body in their own way that isn't necessarily inflicting direct harm on another person, which I think is a basic human moral code that we should probably integrate. Does it do harm to others? But even if it's unsafe, like, that's their choice to do whatever they want. And personally, I would encourage, obviously, family structures and institutions to help people who are, you know, self-damaging or self-hurting through substance use. But it doesn't matter if it's recreational or spiritual, or you're doing it to just get crazy cool ideas to write stories or paint pictures or whatever. That's up to personal choice. The whole spiritual element of it is something I found value in, and many other people are looking for that type of value, so we should be having these discussions. But it doesn't put on a higher or lower place in the spectrum of human experience that using them for spiritual integration and exploration is better or worse than any other potential use.
Yeah. Do you think there's a shift in the global consciousness about psychedelics?
I would definitely say that there's something happening there that you could probably track back to like mid 2000, maybe early 2000s. Like, it kind of started off with the publishing of Rick Strassman's book DMT, and obviously the resurgence or the return of Terence McKenna's work posthumous, you know, like him coming back and people listening to these things, and things like stoned ape theory. And Roland Griffith's work brought the discussion, the legitimate discussion, back into the ecology, the psychic ecology of academia. And it's just with guys like MAPS, Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies, and people like Joe Rogan, who's a very influential person for a huge subset of people, talking about it, and more people opening up and talking about, like, okay, entheogens, what's this all about? And being very public about it, getting cool podcasts going. Lorenzo from the Psychedelic Salon, he was doing it for a long time, and there's more that have come out like that. Martin Ball's Entheogenic Evolution is a good example. And even guys like, personally, people that really inspire me that openly talk about entheogens and psychedelics, like Dave Asprey and Daniel Vitalis. There's more and more people talking about this, and the more talk, the more, say, questioning of, oh, so these people are saying things in a way that I hadn't thought of before. Are my thoughts, you know, are they based on truth? Are these correct? Because if I'm questioning, then there's reason to go in and say, like, maybe there's a logical fallacy in here that's blocking me from truly understanding, if there's logical sense being made from other people. And I think that'll make a change, and it has already been making a change, you know, with Amber Lyons and Reset.me. Mm. Like, all of these things are pretty increasingly bigger. Like, seeing CNN reporting on psilocybin mushrooms, you know, I mind you, it was still like big media propaganda campaign, like everything that streams through that. I'm pretty sure CNN's like 24/7 news, right? Like, but it was there. It popped up into the global mind of the digital realm, expressed through the filters of big media farmhand, right? And so, yeah, I definitely think there's a change happening there. Whether or not I want to read into or draw conclusions about what this means to the consciousness of the planet and the consciousness of humanity, I don't know if I want to go there, but it definitely leads a lot of very, very interesting questions on where humanity is going with the resurgence of these, you know, ancient Marsilius Iliade called, you know, techniques of ecstasy and the discovery of authentic spiritual experience in a vast section of the human race while we approach, and you know, a great extinction on our planet and maybe the destruction of our ecology. And I just heard Daniel Vitalis, a fantastic nature-based philosopher, say a really big moment, which is the approaching extinction of the wild human, right? With sort of the wild human, the expression of humanity that still lives the way we did before we started changing our genetic expression and specializing through agriculture and other things. The people that, you know, still live in the jungle, still live tribal lives. Like that's an expression of our species that's about to go extinct. That's big. There's a lot of really interesting things happening that can be seen as negative, but then a lot of really beautiful things that are happening that can be seen as positive. So I said that I didn't want to go into this, the potentials of this consciousness, blah, blah, blah. I kind of did, but
I think there's a lot of things there that kind of really work into that, because nowadays a lot of people make these experiences because they read about it, hear about it, and, you know, get curious about it. And of course they encounter states of being that they have probably never encountered before, and now they look also for answers, I guess, you know. I mean, of course they should look into themselves, but sometimes, you know, you kind of need some help from the outside to guide you back to yourself. And so I think it's interesting that now this happens. And also the question is, okay, how will that actually affect all these people? I mean, do they have guides? Do they have elders, people who have, you know, some experience with these things, whatever it is that they do? And I mean, we hope to, with, you know, featuring people like you, give people the chance to learn a little bit about it, because I think in some way I agree with you that consciousness should be free, of course. I mean, everybody should do what they want with their consciousness in the realms of that they not harm anybody else. But on the other hand, also, you know, if people take a whole big dose of something and they get shut out of themselves and have to reintegrate that back without anybody in there. I mean, it's a classic thing about people having a spiritual experience and have nobody to talk about it, and they think I'm crazy. And then somehow this gets lost, because if you do not work on that, then it kind of scatters, or you kind of get scarred for a longer time. So I think it's really important that we kind of find a way to, you know, let people know about people like you or other people that can, at least either with books or with talks or anything, give them some kind of a framework to work with it, and then also see the potential in continuing maybe that framework.
Yeah, I completely agree in the importance of having people exposed to others who have done the work or gone deep, that have maps that can work as guides. Like I said, the grander philosophical end, I believe in freedom of consciousness. Right, and freedom of consciousness. We can't say freedom for everyone, but only in these certain spaces.
That's true. Right?
So it's like, if I say I believe in freedom of consciousness, it means like freedom to do whatever you want. Now, I believe in freedom of consciousness, and then I also believe that it's important to have people offer the tools to use things in an informed way. And if we're going to go into these places, it's like going into the jungles of the mind. And some of us can get dropped off in the middle of the jungle of the mind and find our way back, right? Others might not find their way back the same. So it's good to have somebody have explained, like, oh, you know, the basic topography of the jungle, so that if you go too deep, you can get yourself back. You know, like to use that map metaphor, maybe to give you a map to how to get back, or maybe to be a guide to actually take you there and bring you back. Like that's kind of the role of the curandero in the ayahuasca traditions, to, you know, like kind of be the person that like literally and figuratively leads you into the jungles and holds a space for you to quote unquote do work. Personally, I like the idea of to explore and learn and then come back.
There is, right? Mm. Yeah. One aspect that I found really interesting is the aspect of the mushroom as the teacher. And then you wrote this essay about, like, how that relates also to Sufism, and as I'm a practicing Sufi for a few years and have a Sheikh as a teacher, I found it very enlightening, very interesting, and so I'd like, of course, to get into this a little bit. Maybe you can explain to the audience, because that's a lot of concepts which probably not everybody has heard of. So I guess we kind of laid the groundwork for the psilocybin experience and what you learned and how you worked it. And can you maybe tell us what, I mean, I think a few weeks back I talked a little bit longer as usual. Yeah. I mean, I don't really talk about much about my personal practice, but a few years back I talked a little bit about it. So some of the audience may be a little bit familiar with Sufism, but maybe you can just give us a little insight of how you perceive the similarities and differences, and how what led you to write this essay?
Ooh, yeah. Well, what led me to write this essay was spontaneously finding a copy of The Knowing Heart by, who I can't remember
Kabi
his Helminski. First name.
Kabi Helminski.
Yes, yeah, Helminski. I remembered his last name. And really enjoying it. Just really enjoying the way that it was organized. And as I was reading it, I was getting all these insights about how this relates to practice with a mushroom, and how to sort of build the personal mythos of, or you know, map structures that enable us to work with the mushroom. And I'm kind of like dusting off some papers on my the desk inside of my psyche for this essay, because it's been a little while since I've even revisited the concept, but or at least relating to the Sufism. I just saw all these correlations and started to see how to maybe draw them together in a way that could reference it. And like I said, like these things are symbolic processes of the psyche, and then these symbolic processes can be externalized as techniques, maps, or processes that could be shared into a cultural context, you know, externalizing internal processes to be guided through and build community around, etc., in varying spectrums of healthy or unhealthy ways. And I just saw something really beautiful in the Sufism, which, in my very basic understanding, is like a mystical type tradition of embodying the essence of God, which is the basic nature of reality, the supreme truth of existence, into one's life and into community, and how to allow that to inform, you know, basic human goodness and basic human patterns of embodiments of those divine. And then there's the whole process of refining the psyche, and through the spiritual practice such as spiritual community and spiritual discussion, and exploring one's inner wisdom in reference to another, who I pronounce it as Sikh, but I'm obviously like a Westerner that knows very little about the appropriate pronunciation, in reference to a person who's considered to be having achieved spiritual maturity, so that that can work as your guide into the jungles of the mind, into the jungles of spiritual potential in ourselves, and there being a variety of attributes that would be seen as attributes of the divine, excuse me, manifesting in the human person, such as basic human goodness, presence, you know, love, care, wisdom. And I imagine you could definitely elaborate on these things much more than I could. And seeing the correlation between these two things, I just thought it would be interesting to draw this bridge, to create this lateral connection between these two areas of study, these two types of spiritual practice, just to engage the discussion, to like, let's talk about this, let's entertain the ideas, you know?
Yeah, I was very happy, actually, also, I mean, you actually talked about it a little bit in Decomposing the Shadow, when you actually made the comparison already there, and then you kind of emphasized a little bit on in the essay. And I think the whole idea of the student-teacher relationship, that's, I think, one of the things where I could easily see the connection, because what is pretty obvious is that you cannot overcome your ego by yourself. I mean, this is just not working. I mean, how you pull yourself out of the sand, you know?
It's like one hand clapping.
It kind of, yeah, right. And so you basically need somebody, or maybe even something else, and that really is at least, I mean, of course we all connected and, you know, we all know that, but just on that level is somebody else who can help you to overcome your ego. And in Sufism, the Sheikh's role is basically that, and the Sheikh reflects you to yourself, even if you, I mean, I just had, like, he was here in Germany for a few weeks, and I just had a really interesting thing about, like, my personal deficiency in being a parent. And he really reflected that very stark and strict. I mean, he's a very loving person, you know, but in this moment, he really reflected to me very strongly. And it kind of reminded me, you know, of like in an ayahuasca experience when like the ayahuasca teacher, whatever you want to call it, is stern, strict, and just tells you this is it. And, you know, there's no way around it. And you don't want to see it. But on the other hand, you're very glad that something, somebody showed it to you, because only then you can actually, you know, work on this and find it out. And I guess from reading your book, that was basically the role of the mushroom. It showed you yourself, but it also helped you. I mean, I only had one ayahuasca experience, which to me was so deep. I'm still working on it 2 years later. And I really appreciated it. But without the help of my sheikh, who was really helpful in reintegrating everything that happened at that point, I don't know if I would, you know, still be a integrated person, because there was so much going on in this one big trip.
Right.
But so he actually also was that, the help and the guide and the, you know, the person who knows the map, who knows the mind, and could tell me all about what was going on there and why was this fear coming up and how this fear relates to that and all these things. So, and I saw, okay, you did the whole thing with the mushroom, but it was very similar in the sense. So I really appreciated the essay that you wrote. So maybe you can go a little bit deeper into the student teacher relationship on your end.
Right. Well, I'll just initiate by saying that the essay is called Cultivating the Teacher, and if anyone wants to read it, they can get it on the Cypress UK 2014 Volume 3 anthology, which you can just find on cypressuk.com, I think. It's their most recent release. But dusting off the papers on my inner desk, the student-teacher relationship is to say that what you're doing is engaging in a relative dynamic with what you apply as being an expression of spiritual wisdom that you're learning from, and in turn you put yourself in a student role of exploring what's coming up and saying, how does this integrate, what is it showing me about myself, etc. And with the mushroom, you go into it saying, okay, like, this is a teacher, but for the first little while you don't understand how the teacher is teaching. And so you just have to kind of continue to be a student and be earnest and paying attention, etc. And then over time, as one learns to be a better student, which means one learns to be more attentive, be more present, be more supple in receiving lessons, the teacher becomes more capable of sharing lessons. And so in the dynamic between the student and teacher, the potential complexity and broad reaching implications of the lessons being received increase. I guess that's kind of what I'm receiving from it.
That's a very good point. I think you also quote Alex Gray somewhere where he says, like, however you approach your guru, if you approach your guru as a dog, he will be a dog for you. If he's a friend, he's a friend. Or if he's the most enlightened, highest being in the world, then that's what's reflected to you. And that's what I saw in your writings about your time with a mushroom. Again, like how you approached it, that was also reflected back on you.
Right. It's a dynamic process too, especially with people. With the mushroom, it's different because, you know, I won't go into whether or not, you know, the mushroom is a sentient entity or whatever, but it's a dynamic of inner process. It's the mushroom is experiencing itself or exposing itself in your inner processes. It's all happening within the psyche, right? Though in the dynamic of another person, right, say the Sikh or the guru, etc., It's a feedback between the two, and there's a couple of things that come up there. One is that Alex Gray premise, and then the other is sort of the illusion of self, or the Athenian theory of everything kind of process, where a lot of my thought processes, what I perceive to be my sense of self, a significant portion of it is actually a responsiveness to the implicit messages of the stimuli of people around me, and that a lot of the activity that I see that say the mirror neuron activity that's happening in reference to other people is being processed or rendered as my own thought patterns, which I perceive to be my sense of self. And so if with an awareness of going in, and this is obviously a feedback of going in and acknowledging someone as having spiritual wisdom, then not only do I then open myself up to receiving spiritual wisdom from this person, but I also open up a dynamic wherein the way that I interact with them on an implicit level pulls that out of them. That's where the student-teacher dynamic can work as a feedback loop for both parties becoming better students and teachers, and vice versa, because the teacher learns how to be a better teacher from the student, and the student learns how to become a better student from the teacher, etc. And we can engage this. Now, the interesting thing is when self-awareness gets employed in this, when there's a sense of self-awareness and all of the stimuli that's coming in and through, and the weird changes and thought patterns and dynamics that come from this play of mirror neurons and the illusioned self, social environment, stimulus, etc., when it's all filtered through self-awareness, then there's a clarity in how one can approach the situation to learn and teach, to learn and offer, etc. And that dynamic of student-teacher can play out in almost any interaction, though within the ritualized safe space of, say, student-teacher to the mushroom, or student-teacher to the Sikh, or student-teacher to the guru, as long as there's an understanding that this is a personal empowerment thing. These lessons are coming from me in dynamic relationship with this other, and not a disempowerment where all the wisdom is projected onto the other being as the high, holy, whatever. Then in those safe spaces, there can be, especially with something like the mushroom, which accesses the inner wisdom, or somebody who is quote-unquote spiritually mature, who has done a lot of the work and has cultivated the self-awareness to hold a presence that brings out the wisdom inherent in ourselves, it can be a healthier, say, more straightforward route, more effective or efficient in getting to the embodiment of the self-awareness within the student.
Yeah, I think that's great. I really, when I was rereading your essay, I was really like reminded, yeah, I should really be a better student, you know, because of what you just said. Only then the teacher can actually become the best teacher possible. And it's also interesting that in Sufism, when we call it the bayat or the taking hand, when you basically ask your teacher to become your teacher, the teacher also asks you if he is allowed to become your teacher. It's a mutual thing because, only if you allow the teacher to be your teacher, and only on the to the degree that you do that, he can hold, or she, whatever, can give you what you're looking for. And I think that's always the biggest struggle for many students in these kinds of relationships, actually to really become the good student or to really offer themselves up as much as they can, and then also receive the thing and whatever that is in the specific moment. I was really appreciative to read it again because, sometimes, especially in the way we interact with our Sheikh, he's a very, he's a American guy in the 50s, and he's, very funny, and he can be very normal, and you can kind of easily forget sometimes, who are you actually in the presence with. And it's always another practice of presence to not really forget that, even though it can be just, a fun evening, and you were just there, and it's just like making jokes, everybody's laughing, and, but it's still, you hold the presence of, okay, this is still the symbol of the all that I'm with, and my intention is to learn to merge with that in some way, and
remembrance is a strong element of the Sufi practice,
exactly,
right?
Yeah, I mean, that's basically the Sufi practice. We call it dhikr, and it's always remembering. I mean, it's and also this kind of gets a little bit to the other book you wrote, The Soundscapes and Psychedelics. You wrote a lot about your singing and being in community, and I mean, these things are one of our main practices, basically being together and chanting kind of mantras. It's if you look at all the spiritual paths, they're basically doing the same thing anyway, but in our tradition it's called dhikr, and we do it loud, and we do like it's a mantra singing, and it's a group, and all the things that you wrote in the Soundscapes book about how to use these kinds of methods is there, you know, the surrendering mm-hmm. to the bigger thing in the chanting. If it's a techno club and everybody's doing the same thing, or if it's a group of, you know, dervishes sitting in a circle around the sheikh and doing la la la. I wouldn't say it's the same thing, but there is the same principles at work, and it's the degree of presence of the people that actually make it a holy or just a mundane experience, probably.
Yeah, it's building a space using a variety of practices and a set of intentions and a manner of engagement that allows the person to break the thinking mind, enter flow, peak, you know, mystical experiences, spiritual awareness, etc. And that has a cascading effect of benefit on the mind and on the body. And if we just called it, you know, spiritual ecstasy, and we talked about the potentials I laid out in soundscapes and psychedelics as to how that could affect the whatever processes in the body are associated to the placebo effect that allow for spontaneous healing, whether we want to look at it energetically or whether we want to look at how it changes the psyche by laying new neurological or establishing new neurological architecture based on the rapid expansion of new neural pathways to increase the capacity to render such an experience, or we want to look at it as the way that it affects the immune system in states of flow, which is a huge area of study right now. I can't remember the name of the author, but the book is called The Rise of the Superman, mm-hmm. and going into how much these states, when activated, can rapidly develop somebody's capacities to do things, whether it be self-awareness in the sort of intention of spiritual development, or whether it be the capacity to pull off crazy tricks in extreme sports, or even heal the body from degenerative diseases. The author has a long talk about how he incidentally used flow to heal himself from Lyme's disease. So, and this is all could be associated too to the same thing of people finding spiritual healing in going into the jungle and taking ayahuasca, or finding it, you know, in spontaneous healing experiences within their religious or spiritual circles, where that state of ecstasy, that state of flow, is being opened, and it's a basic human potential that we have that is also extraordinary. And learning to access it, whether it be through whatever practice we find, in a way that allows us to integrate it within the intentions of who we are and what we seek to build inside of ourselves, is a beautifully creative venture in one's experience of human life and the time that they have it.
Do you have an opinion about the, I mean, we talked a little bit earlier about the resurgence of psychedelics and how maybe a lot of people are so closed off by civilization and everything that's going on, especially like if you live in a big city, that they cannot access this inner state without this, like, say, the nuclear bomb of a really strong psychedelic dose? Because it seems to me sometimes that in earlier times, people had an easier time, maybe, for whatever reason, to go into these states. And these days, it's... If you talk to people in the West, most people never really had, or maybe they had a little bit when they were younger, but then they closed it off because it's weird or something. And nowadays, the amount of people who go to the jungle or, you know, go to other places to take these things is increasing. And do you think it's necessary to go this full on, or is it just like a thing right now? I mean, I don't know.
Do I feel like it's necessary? Well, that's really contextual. It really depends on the situation. I definitely can see how the process of civilization, which is to be of, in, or relating to the city, and the city being an invention of sort of the Industrial Revolution, what we've been doing, and obviously the advent of agriculture, and what we've been doing is changing our diets and habitats and the way that we live our lives to accidentally or not have selectively breeded ourselves to a certain type of human expression. And that is working, toiling, a lot of thinking, productivity, ambition, go, go, go. And, And in a way, this can be very detrimental. We're seeing this physiologically detrimental in the expression of increased chronic diseases and neurodegenerative diseases coming up. And we're also seeing it in the decrease in the security of the food structure. This is all related to diet and habitat, what we eat, where we spend our time on a physical element, but also on a non-physical informational element. Right? This is changing us, and some people are going like, whoa, you know, how do I get out of this? And obviously it's very difficult to be civilized, which is to be of interrelating to the city, which is the very thing that blocked us from the essence of, say, spiritual calmness, or to be able to be in a state of healthy self that isn't wrapped in the social mirror neuronal stimuli of city living or the city self. And it's hard to be in the city and do that, but there are ways to break it. And one of those ways are the psychedelics. And I'm not going to use the nuclear bomb reference because I mean, it's a great reference, but it comes with a whole subset of like,
you're right, yeah.
But the effective catalyst, the effective tool for catalyzing these states of awareness, such as psychedelics. And for a lot of people, that's kind of what they need because, you know, like for myself, I could have moved away to India and like studied yoga. I could have gone to the jungle to find a teacher there, or went to the mountaintop to, you know, study Kung Fu in the temple or whatever, wherever it is that I go to get out of the thinking mind, to get away from the environments of recycling traumatic defensive postural patterns psychically and physiologically within myself for my own issues, but within the illusioned self occasioned by the diet and habitat of the civilized, you know, human. It could be any number of places that I could have gone to do this, but the psychedelics were accessible, right? And they worked with certain intentions. You could send yourself running around all day long, actually making the whole situation worse. And that's why we're having these conversations. And you mentioned that being one of your intentions with having people like me talk. So I can see how the psychedelics are playing a role because they work and they show people the change very quickly.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. When setting and dose is properly calibrated, they show people the change. Like you are before the end of the evening, you have seen the change. Now this is where the integration comes in, because seeing the change is not being the change.
That's a good right? point.
Mm-hmm.
So the integration process becomes key, and that's where, you know, discussions with people like myself, but, you know, various other people who have very strong, you know, effective work on these things, such as guys like James Fadiman or Martin Ball, you know, or like I said, I already mentioned them. I'm really stoked on this guy right now, like guys like Daniel Vitalis, offering models to understand how to come back from these experiences, offering models on how to integrate into your life whatever set of choices and actions, thoughts, and behavior, or actions, thoughts, and feelings that we can use to engender I don't want to say return, but a fuller expression of ourselves as humans beyond the civilized mind.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. That's why we call our podcast "There Are Many Ways Leading to Om." You can become a Shaolin Kung Fu master, or you know, can go to an Indian guru or whatever it is. I think you pretty much summed it up very good in the sense that it's the traumas that we carry that we kind of somehow have to dissolve and become fuller what really is ourselves, whatever that actually is. Everybody has to find out by themselves or herself.
And I want to say, and I don't know how many people say this, but I think that the traumas that you've been given, and I'm sorry if people who have been given really intense traumas in their lives misconstrue my words here, because some of us have a bigger subset of things to deal with because of lineages, generations of issues. But the traumas that we have, this is almost like a birthright that we've been given, that we become the vertex of creating an entirely new expression of humanity with the choices that we make in our lives. If we understand how to go into the traumas that have been passed through in generations, that are actually encoded genetically in us, our heritage, psychologically and emotionally and behaviors and issues or whatever. Some people call these past lives. I think there's a lot of frou-frou, illusory mistakes and weird, you know, tangents with the whole past lives thing that block people from understanding what this could be as a potential. But we have an opportunity in ourselves to heal these things and then create the, say, to decompose the shadow of generations, which has an effect in the way that we treat others, which changes with self-awareness, the social context of how others identify with themselves because of the illusion self that we've been talking about. But it also creates programming. We're genetically programming ourselves through a process called epigenetics to engender recessive genes that will express themselves in, you know, generations to come as the physiological, psychological behaviors. So that's the cellular behavior and also the psycho-emotional behavior of the children to come. And we can free ourselves of these histories of trauma, because there's nothing good or bad about anything that exists. Good and bad are human concepts. We could look at the play of the divine, of the play of reality, and see that there are things that are perceivably dark and perceivably light, that we could see things as perceivably divine and perceivably evil. And because of our attachment to good and bad in the human value structure, we see evil as bad, obviously, unless we're really weird. But we see evil as bad and the divine as good, and we maybe want to eliminate evil, eliminate the bad, and live in the divine. But this is a mistake. Without one or the other, the whole system falls apart, you know. Without Stanislav Grof, brilliant man, talks about this quite an important or poignant way in The Cosmic Game, and he talks about how, you know, for example, the evils of infectious diseases that have killed so many, and this is poignant topic right now with Ebola and with the discussion now of the spreading of the bubonic plague again in Madagascar. Like, there's some really intense things with infectious diseases happening in this world. Without our history of facing the quote-unquote evil of infectious diseases, we would never have developed the medical technology of vaccination. We would never have been able to come to a point as a human culture to see, hey, we've created beauty out of this. We've saved lives now. We have come to a place where we can stop this thing. And I think that we will come to a place where we stop this thing, you know, from at least wiping out any more people, as terrifying it is at this time. And so I don't really see this. I see evil as necessary in order for us to have this beautiful process. And whether or not you want to connect with the idea that all of life in this universe manifesting as the human experience is a play of the divine creative principle creating this elaborate subset of potential to experience itself through the relativistic human, you know, like us and them, you know, I and not I, self and other, that we have the opportunity to, as expressions of the divine creative potential, transmute evil, transmute darkness, a necessary element of existence within ourselves, through healing ourselves of mental emotional traumas, of healing ourselves in the body, of creating good for ourselves in spite of the bad, to use those terminology, and then to pass down what we've learned and how we've changed into other generations and other people through conversations like this, you know, in the present moment of life, and then in generations to come, in exposures of, like, say, you know, the great writers, artisans, you know, teachers of the past whose works still continue to influence, right? And then also genetically in how it's going to be expressed in our offspring and, you know, our children's children's children. In to say, use the North American indigenous idea of looking at our choices as how does this affect seven generations to come. Like, I think, and I've gone on a really intense, like, super way out there tangent, but the traumas, the challenges that we have in ourselves now are an opportunity we've been given to create beauty as expressions of the divine creative potential, as expressions of something gorgeous that doesn't exist anywhere else on the planet as far as we know. And this, even if it's just in ourselves and is never passed along, has an effect on the ongoing development of humanity into a fuller expression of ourselves and the potential for basic human goodness, compassion, etc., and the capacity to navigate darkness. There will always be darkness.
Yeah.
No matter how many
duality.
Traumas I go through, there'll be more.
Yeah. How would you have anything? I mean, you said it with a vaccination as an example, but everything. I mean, you know, I mean, the old things like day and light, night and up and down and woman and man, if there would be no duality, reality wouldn't be here. And that's
right.
What happens when reality disappears, of course. Then there is no duality anymore. And I mean, that's what everybody's kind of seeking and in many ways we can find. And I think it's really more important to actually become conscious or work on your on becoming conscious and not so much about how you do it. I mean, there's less effective ways or better ways, and everybody is different. So, you know, for one person this is good and that's bad, and you know, this is all, again, it's there's a duality involved because everybody has a different mindset and look at life. So for some people, you know, the psychedelics are good, some people are not. Some people probably should, you know, I don't know, find a guru or maybe just read a good book or go out to nature or, you know, find meaning.
Start meditating.
I mean, yeah. I think that's a very good point. Yeah, we haven't really talked about that, and you mentioned it several times, and I think I totally agree that that's the basic of everything. I mean, even if you do psychedelics, if you do not meditate every day, this will just go, you know, away. And if you don't, meditation is also great. And and of course, it helps you in your real life all the time. I mean, if you're in a meditative state as much as you can, you know, you can navigate life much easier.
Yeah.
I had
my psilocybin experience a few weeks ago.
Awesome.
And for the first time, I took 5 mL DMT, and
wow.
in the background there was this Brian Eno Thursday afternoon, and every time when I use it now for meditating, and every time I hear this piece of music, I'm constantly going right back into the experience, not full on, mm-hmm. but. It's like you said, remember and the essence of it, and it's a very, very, yeah, it's a very good experience every morning, almost every morning.
So wait, you're talking about having used 5-MeO DMT within the psilocybin experience?
Yeah, because in the first evening there is 5-MeO DMT, and on the second day. There are the mushrooms.
And 5-MeO DMT is still quite legal in most places around the world, except for the United States at this point, hey?
I guess it's
it is
in
illegal
Germany.
In Germany, but the ritual
in Netherlands,
is in Netherlands. It's
yeah.
It's not illegal there.
Not
in the toad version, at least.
Yeah, not in the
toad
version.
I mean, Ollie is advertising it, so I guess...
Yeah, no, it's legal in the Netherlands. And... It was such an intense experience, so that on the next day when the mushrooms when there was the real psilocybin experience, I don't want to do it anymore because I don't know why, because I had this strange feeling, and Roland said to me before, when you have a strange feeling in your gut, you don't have to do it. So I said to Olli, I don't want to do it, we
negotiated about it.
Yeah, and he took a little bit off my dose of mushrooms, and then I drank it anyway. And the experience I had, it was like I was very stubborn that evening. I don't want mm-hmm. to. I wanted to go into it, and I said, "Well, you don't get me, mushroom. You don't. I don't want to have this experience right now. I'm just following a herd. So I'm just watching the people have fun. But I'm like a small child almost. I said, I don't want to do it. And strangely enough, or funny enough, when I had a vision, when I was thinking into a vision, every time I got an my vision was in 8 megabits, like from an old Commodore computer, like an old so like the mushroom was saying, so you don't want to get teached, so I give you only this 8 bits graphics or visions or stuff like that. So it was okay, but on the next day I finally realized why I was so afraid of the mushrooms, because I had this wonderful DMT experience, this 5-MeO DMT experience, and that was pure bliss, and it was pure love, and it's such a great experience. And I was afraid that the experience with the mushrooms could take that away. So I was reluctant to go into the mushrooms. But in the evening, I wasn't aware of that, because I don't know. But
it's interesting, because it seems as if that fear actually usurped your choices, which then in turn caused you to create the very context that you were afraid of, because the closure, the saying no, which is, to me, that's all expressions of the shadow.
Yeah.
It's all a part of the process, resistance, etc.
Yeah.
Actually created that very experience for you, where you're uncomfortable and you didn't like it. And probably in your mind, you were like, I didn't want this. This is not like the other experience. And you almost accidentally created the very thing that you were afraid of because of not, I don't know, for whatever reason it was. But that's very interesting.
Yeah, yeah. Because it would, and the other part was, the 5-MeO is 10 minutes. So it's like a roller coaster. And the mushrooms, it's like it's far longer, and I was afraid of that. I was afraid of going in and out of. So I was basically paddling on the surface of the water, and occasionally I got a little dive into the water and had this 8 megabit visions. But that's what I took out of it. But but I'm pretty sure that next time I would I see it differently. I hope. Yeah.
I mean, I think it's a good training ground for surrender, because in the end, wherever you are, you have to surrender to what is.
And I wasn't able to surrender. Yeah.
I mean, I can totally relate to that. It took me an eternity and more during the ayahuasca trip to actually getting close to surrender. I mean, it felt like forever. I mean, honestly.
Yeah.
Forever.
Yeah.
But the thing is, in normal life, we have to do that and we have to learn it, because if we are not surrendered to what is, we feel bad. I mean, whatever it is. It's the weather, it's the people, it's the circumstances, whatever. And if we surrender to that moment, I mean, really surrender, then we actually do not feel bad anymore. And I think psychedelics in that sense, I mean, it's on a cosmic scale, obviously, in that point. But if you just boil it down to everyday life, I think it's a good training ground, and then you can learn about it.
Sure. Yeah.
Do you have a little more energy? I mean, I don't know. We don't want to take all of your time, but we, of course, would love to talk about your ayahuasca experiences, but I don't know if you want to do that.
I think I would love to talk with you guys about the ayahuasca experience at some point, but I actually have another Skype call coming up, and I have several things on my plate this morning.
Yeah,
so
it's okay. We can maybe do it.
Maybe you could invite me back to the podcast.
We would love to.
Sure,
would love to at some point. Great, yeah, let's do that. Because I think we spoke, I don't know, what time is it? It's probably 1.5 hours or something that we've been.
Almost 8 o'clock.
Yeah, I think that's pretty good, because also our listeners, you know, I mean, I usually listen to podcasts, like, you know, bit by bit, because as you talked, I mean, Joe Rogan is like 3 hours. When do we ever have time? 3 hours in a straight 3 hours. So I always listen to it a little bit here and there. But why don't we just close here and talk again at some point, whenever you want and whenever we have time and whatever. It sounds great.
Sure.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
I really thank you so much. It was a great conversation. Maybe you can tell the listeners where they can find you on the web, or if they want to know more about you. We mentioned it several times, but maybe in the end again.
Yeah, absolutely. So you can find me just by Googling James W. Gesso or searching for the title of my book, Decomposing the Shadow. I'm pretty sure the first two pages that come up on Google are about me. So you could also check me out at jameswgesso.com, which is basically the consolidation page for all the stuff that I do for things like podcasts like this and videos, other interviews, articles of me and about me. All of it is consolidated through that website. And on that website, you can, in the top right corner under social, you can sign up for my newsletter. And it goes out about once a month, and I just put out all the updates and stuff and what I'm doing. Got some new book projects coming out, got some new articles that'll be coming out quite soon, exploring a lot of the things that we've talked about here and even deeper into whole new areas. I've got a really exciting winter coming up for work.
Yeah, you mentioned in the Soundscapes book, I think it's Psilocybin Stories, a trilogy of psychedelic darkness. You're working on that. Is that still
Yeah, a trilogy in psychedelic darkness. Now, it didn't end up coming out because I just decided that I'd rather prioritize my summer tour and being a little bit relaxed, and I just didn't want to go so balls to the wall this year as I did last year. I wanted to have a little bit more breathing room. So realistically, for everyone following it, for yourself, I'll likely launch a Indiegogo campaign in the springtime, which will work as also a promotional campaign for the book, and it'll likely come out in the fall. But yeah, it's a Psilocybin Stories, a trilogy in psychedelic darkness. And it takes what was learned. So in Decomposing the Shadow, it's not a storytelling narrative in any way. It's very much less about my experience, which is just the introduction, and more about exploring the philosophical, psychological implications of the mushrooms and society, emotion, etc. And it's got a very nonfiction vibe. Well, Psilocybin Stories is taking that as the basic philosophical substrate and exploring it and various other topics through the lens of my personal experiences in a storytelling narrative that go through three specific experiences, each of which increase in complexity as the timeline of them is me getting deeper and deeper into the mushroom practice, and each one increases in darkness, varying levels of darkness. Now, the meta structure that I have organized these stories and the narrative style and the contents and stuff in is a topic for a whole other discussion, but I'm really looking forward to sharing it.
Sounds very intriguing. Yeah, you're looking forward to reading it. Yeah, great. So, okay, thanks again, James W. Gesso. I hope everybody enjoyed the conversation, and of course we're going to continue at some point. And yeah, thank you so much. Have a good day. And
thanks. Thanks for having me.
Stay in touch.
Will do. Take care.
Okay.
Well, that was interesting, wasn't it?
that sounded like something from an English course in school. Yes, it was Gary.
Tom and Helga, my sister's in the house.
What are you talking about?
Yeah, that was one the first sentence I read in English.
Which one was it? Tom and Helga?
In a school book.
What was it?
Come here, Tom and Helga. My sister's in the house.
My sister's in the house.
In the house.
Yeah, James was in the house with us, at least via the internet. Thank you so much, James. That was a great, great interview. We enjoyed it very much.
Indeed.
And yeah, if you want to know more about his work, then go check his website, www.jameswgesso.com. And if you want to listen to more of our podcast, then at least go to our Facebook page. Viele Wege führen nach Om, which is really difficult to spell. I'm going to do it once. It's V-E. No, it's totally wrong. You edit that out. V-I-E-L-E-F-U-E-H-R-E-N-N-A-C-H-O-M.com. No, not .com. .com is our website. But if you type that in, then you might find us on our Facebook page, and you can friend us, and then you will know if there's going to be another English guest at some point. We hope to have some more, but usually our podcast is in German, so most of you guys probably don't want to listen to it. But so if you befriend us on Facebook, at least you will know if we find somebody from... like who speaks English on some other podcast.
Yeah. Okay.
So thank you so much for listening, and we hope you have a good day. And we usually have this little thing where we say at the end, I've never tried it in Germany.
No,
so
no.
May peace be upon you.
Goodbye.
Namaste.
And I can't say it in English.
We can edit the break. Let's think about it. Let's überlegen. Was ist auf Deutsch?
Alles Gute auch beruflich. Tschüss. Bye means bye. Für
alles Gute auch beruflich. Good luck also in your job. Sag das nochmal.
Good luck also in your job.
Yeah.
But that sounds strange.
Really strange. Well, anyway, that's us trying
to speak. In German, it's funny.
Yeah, of course, it's very funny. We laugh our ass off the time.
Yeah.
No, okay. So, I think we should stop now. All right. Okay. Thank you very much. Bye. Bye-bye.